All right, well, let's see here. Make sure I got this going. Go ahead and grab your Bibles and make your way back to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So I pull up my notes here. 1 Corinthians 7. Where we left off last time, we're going to continue walking through this really pivotal passage about marriage, divorce, singleness, remarriage. So much here that we as Christians need to think through. I mean, you think of all those categories. I mean, every single one of us at some point in our life is going to find ourselves in one of those categories. And we're going to need to know what honors Christ and how even at times we might move in a God-honoring way from one of those categories to another. And so this chapter, as I've said last time, is significant for that very reason. It gives us probably the most information. Paul seeks to shepherd the Corinthians here in the most detailed way and of all of the New Testament about how to do that, about what God thinks about your relationship status. Whether you're married, you're single, you're divorced, you're remarried, whether your spouse has died, we get all of what God thinks about those categories here. And just a quick review for you. If you remember, chapter 7 here begins a section where Paul's seeking to answer questions now that the Corinthians are beginning to ask. And you see that in the refrain that's going to come several times now from here on out to the end of the letter, beginning of verse 1, now concerning. And then he'll talk about, and he'll bring up an issue that they were bringing to him, and he'll address that. And in this chapter specifically, in our section that we're going to try to finish at least down to verse 16 tonight, Paul, if you remember, is seeking now to answer questions that the Corinthians had about the impact of their faith on their marriage relationships. Now that they'd come to Christ, now that God had saved them out of a pagan culture, what are they to do? What are they to make of this relationship, this intimate relationship of marriage between husband and wife that they all of a sudden find themselves now in as new creatures and new creations? Does our conversion change anything about our relationship status? What does it change? How do we relate now to the relationships that we find ourselves in? And so, beginning in verses 8 through 16, Paul begins to apply this counsel specifically to three categories of people who've all, as we said last time, experienced marriage. Well, by the time you get to verse 25, he's going to then address specifically those who've never been married. But for now, he's talking specifically to people who have experienced marriage. And you remember, just we labeled the categories last time. So notice verses 8 and 9, we called to the previously married. Verses 10 and 11, we said those were the equally married. And verses 12 through 16, we called to the unequally married. Those were the categories that we, those are the labels, actually, that we gave to those categories that Paul seeks to address now. You see, notice the divisions. Verse 8, but I say to the unmarried and to the widows. Verse 10, but to the married. And verse 12, but to the rest. Those are the categories. To the previously married, to the equally married, and to the unequally married. And we're going to cover tonight the last two because we covered 8 and 9 last time. And you remember, though, just to, again, set the context for Paul's overall approach and argument and counsel for these different people in these different scenarios. You remember we said last time, if you just step back and took a big picture run at this, his default counsel to all of these categories of people is really the same. It's for those who've come to Christ in these categories, his counsel, his baseline starting point is remain as you are. You remember? Remain as you are. If you're able to, then remain in this condition and in the state in which God called you to himself. In fact, notice verse 7. Notice the book ends on either end of these three specific categories of people. Notice how he bookends it. Verse 7, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. In other words, he says from the very beginning, look, God has given sufficient grace to you when he saved you for whatever different situation you find yourself in at the moment of your conversion. God has given you grace for that situation. And so look at how he closes, bookends it, verse 17, therefore, only as the Lord has assigned to each one, then as God has called each, in this manner let him walk. Look at verse 20 even. Each man must remain in that condition in which he was called. That is Paul's baseline. He says, singleness isn't better. Singleness isn't more Christian. Being married isn't more Christian or more sanctified. Whatever situation you find yourself in the providence of God when he saves you, you should seek to honor him and glorify him and obey him in that state if you're able. Remain in that condition. Now, of course, as you begin and as we began even to walk through the first category, we saw that, but Paul doesn't pigeonhole everyone in those categories in which they come to Christ. As you see, and as even as you'll see, as we saw, and even as you'll see tonight, as we walk through these different specific categories now in relationship to those who've been married, he's going to say, well, there are exceptions to that rule. There are legitimate ways in which you can move about from category to category. But there are some rules for that too. And so remember, last time we considered his counsel first to the previously married, verses 8 and 9, to the unmarried and widows. And if you missed that, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to that. And you're probably confused as to why I'm categorizing the unmarried as those who've been previously married. We explained that last time. It's best to see them as those who've been divorced, those who've lost their spouses due to divorce, whereas widows are those who've lost their spouses due to death. So both of these comprise a category of those who've been previously married. And in summary, if you remember, what is Paul's counsel to them? Paul's counsel to that group is, it's good if you can remain single like me, and devote yourself to serving the Lord in that state. But, and here's the exception, right? If you don't have that kind of self-control, if you're constantly distracted by a legitimate concern and desire for marriage and for family life, then remember, he says it's better that you get remarried. I think that's what Paul's talking about there. Again, if you're curious about that, why we take it that way, listen to last time. But tonight, then, I just want to finish up these next two groups of people in verses 10 through 16. So let's walk through these next two categories, to the equally married and to the unequally married. Really, both of them are the currently married, right? So whether believer to believer in the equally married category or believer to unbeliever in the second category. These are those, unlike verses 8 and 9, who are now currently married, whereas it was those who were previously married. So listen to let's consider Paul's counsel first then to the group we called the equally married. Look at verses 10 and 11 again. We'll just read it together. But to the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband, but if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. Now, it would seem that with this category, Paul is now giving instructions, like I said, to those who find themselves in a Christian marriage, believer married to believer. And notice what the command is. Okay, notice what the command is. It's kind of interrupted by the parentheses in the middle of at the beginning of verse 11, but there's really two parallel commands here that really are the same, are different ways of saying the same thing to both husband and wife. Did you notice it? That the wife should not leave her husband. And then the end of verse 11, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. Parallel commands, really saying the same thing to both parties, the Christian wife and the Christian husband. In other words, Paul's counsel, Paul's biblical and basic counsel to those who are married as believers to one another is not surprising to us, right? And it's don't get divorced. Don't be unfaithful. Don't leave your spouse. He commands both husband and wife that. Now, a couple important clarifications on the front end for us to understand Paul's language here. First, notice when he says, not I, do you see that? A lot of people get tripped up by this. When he says, not I, but the Lord, that's just Paul's way of referring to this, what he's about to say, as having also been taught by Jesus during his earthly ministry. In other words, this isn't Paul like moving in and out of inspiration mode. It's not Paul saying, hey, you can take it or leave this. Notice in verse 12, he says the exact opposite. And this is where people get tripped up. He says, but to the rest I say, not the Lord. I say, but not the Lord. And so the question is, well, what's going on there? Again, like I said, I don't think Paul's not moving in and out of inspiration mode, whereas he's not saying, well, this is inspired, this is what the Lord's teaching, and this is not inspired, this is just my opinion. No, what he's saying is the first category in verses 10 and 11 is a situation in which Jesus also taught about and addressed in his earthly ministry. Whereas the second one, verses 12 through 16, when he says, I say and not the Lord, again, he's not saying this isn't inspired. He's just saying Jesus never spoke about that category, beginning in verse 12 down through 16. Jesus never directly addressed the issue of a believer being married to an unbeliever. And so the progression here in these two categories, right, from 10 and 11 to 12 through 16, is Paul is summarizing first 10 and 11, Jesus is teaching about marriage and divorce, what Jesus taught himself also. And then in 12 through 16, he's supplementing Jesus' teaching by addressing a new scenario. Okay? You know, that tells us, I mean, just pause there for a moment. It tells us that Jesus' teaching on marriage and divorce, well, recorded for us in Scripture, is not exhaustive, which isn't as blasphemous as it sounds, right? Think about it. The reality is there are circumstances, there are situations in which that Christ never addressed while he lived here on earth. And that's all that Paul is saying. Paul is saying in verses 10 and 11, 10 and 11 is what Jesus himself also taught. But verses 12 through 16, Paul's saying, I'm about to speak about something that Jesus never addressed. So, second clarification, if you notice the two, like I said, parallel commands here, one to the wife not to leave her husband, and the other one at the end of verse 11, the husband should not divorce his wife. What do you notice about those two statements? I'm saying they're parallel, but what do you notice about those two? They're not the same word, right? One is leave and one is divorce. And a lot of people have tried to make a difference of those two things. You really shouldn't. When Paul speaks of leaving and Paul speaks of divorcing, he's talking about the same thing. Okay? Separation in Scripture, in this sense, and divorce refer to the same reality. The change in verbs here are simply stylistic and nothing more. They're not referring to two different things. They're synonymous terms, which, by the way, if you go on in the rest of these verses, you'll see both verbs used interchangeably of both husband and wife. And so leaving is divorcing, divorcing is leaving. And we shouldn't, here's another warning, we shouldn't read into this biblical language the nuance of our modern legal categories of separation that are, you know, states of existing in a marriage where you don't actually legally file, but practically you're separated. Like the Bible knows nothing of that category. When you separate, when you leave your wife or you leave your husband, that amounts to this divorce officially in God's sight. So Jay Adams just maybe puts it well. He says, in the Bible, the modern idea of separation as something less than divorce, whether legal or otherwise, was totally unknown as a viable alternative to divorce. Wherever the word separation appears in the New Testament in connection with divorce, it always refers to separation by divorce. Now, let me be clear here. This is not to say that temporarily, like in the case of maybe like spousal abuse and because of someone's life is in danger, that we wouldn't counsel someone in that circumstance at that moment in time to remove themselves physically from a situation that endangers their life. But you got to understand, you see how that's very different than what Paul's talking about here. Separating, leaving your marriage, in this sense, is to divorce your husband or your wife. Okay? So those are a couple of clarifications. But bottom line, verses 10 and 11, here's the point. Paul, with this prohibition, is placing himself squarely in line with Jesus' teaching about marriage and divorce, right? He doesn't change Jesus' teaching here. Rather, he affirms it, agrees with it, and assumes Jesus' high view of marriage in this command. In verses 10 and 11, he says, don't do it. Don't leave your spouse. Now, when you hear that put in such absolute terms, what's the question you have in your mind if you've ever read the Gospels and Jesus' teaching on marriage and divorce? Anybody know where I'm going with this? Is there a question that, well, is it, here's the question that I think of when I see Paul say this. Is this an absolute command with no exceptions? Right? Can you think of an exception potentially that's given by Christ in the Gospels? Yeah, you're getting closer. Yeah, Matthew 5, Matthew 19, there are two places in which Jesus gives what theologians have called the exception clause and says, of course, he's prohibiting divorce just like Paul is here. So Paul stands on the shoulders of Jesus. But Jesus also does include in his teaching in those two spots an exception for immorality. unfaithfulness due to immorality. And so the question oftentimes, well, the question that pops into my mind is, well, why does Paul not bring that up here? Did you notice? He doesn't bring it up here. We'll explain the first half of verse 11 here in a moment, but I would argue he doesn't have that particular exception or the permission by Christ, and even it reaches back to Moses, Deuteronomy 24, of divorce due to sexual immorality and unfaithfulness. He doesn't bring that up here. And that's caused a lot of people some difficulties here. But let's begin just by affirming what is clear that Paul says here. What is the same about what Paul taught here and what Jesus taught? Okay, listen, like Jesus, if you go to those contexts, Matthew 5, I'll give you the verses. Verses 31 and 32 in the Sermon on the Mount, right, where he's correcting the religious leaders. He's saying, you've heard it said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. And then he corrects their understanding of that, which they were very loose about that. They only made it an issue of paperwork, right? And he says, no, actually, I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, and here's the except for the reason of unchastity or immorality, it's the porneia word group, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And so there's Jesus teaches still even a high view of marriage there. He's raising the bar on the Pharisees and saying, no, it's not just a matter of paperwork. And the other place that you find Jesus' teaching on this is Matthew 19. Actually, flip there for a moment. Well, just look at it, just because it's a longer passage. And let's see if we can draw out what is the same. Like, what does Paul agree with? And then maybe we can figure out why he doesn't bring up the exception clause that Jesus does. Look at Matthew 19, beginning verse 3. Matthew 19, 3. I'll read down to verse 9. Some Pharisees came to Jesus, testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? Right? That was their concern. I mean, they, in fact, if you read some of the rabbis of Jesus' day, I mean, they actually said you can really divorce your wife if she displeases you in any way, if she burns the toast, it was crazy. You go read some of their rabbis, and that was their teaching, and their whole point as taught, as confronted by Jesus in Matthew 5 that we saw earlier, was it could be any reason at all. So long as your paperwork was right, you gave him a certificate. You burned the toast, you know, signed, you know, your husband. And so here come the rabbis, testing Jesus on this. Notice his answer. And he answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Quotes Genesis 2. So, here's his conclusion. They are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore, and you probably heard this in many wedding ceremonies, maybe tomorrow for Josue, what therefore God has joined together, let no man, charizo, separate. It's the same word that Paul uses here at first to describe divorce. And notice, he said to them, well, hang on a second. They said to him, then here's their response. Well, then why? Why did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? And they're referring to Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, and we don't have time to go back there to chase that down. But you notice what they're doing there? Why did Moses command it? And you know what Jesus says to them essentially next here? He says, no, you got it wrong. Moses never commanded divorce. He allowed it. Notice what he says. There's a big difference. He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it's not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except, and here's the exception clause again that Paul kind of leaves out of our context, except for immorality and marries another woman, commits adultery. But you see what his overall point is there? It's actually the same as Paul's. Jesus raises the bar on marriage and says, there is no command to get divorced. Moses never commanded it. He permitted it because of sin. But by and large, the teaching of the Old and New Testament is that you must remain faithful to your spouse at all costs. Jesus is correcting the religious leaders' misinterpretation of Moses. And he highlights the fact that Moses never commanded divorce, though it was allowed for under circumstances because of sin, specifically sexual sin and infidelity. But do you notice, even the allowance that Moses gives and Jesus recognizes in that exception is an accommodation for something that was not ideal, which is why Jesus refers to their hardness of heart here. In fact, if you're still in Matthew 19, notice in verse 10 how the disciples responded after hearing Jesus' view of marriage. Notice verse 10. If the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. You see, they got it. They understood how high of a view of marriage Jesus was putting forth. So Paul, here's what I would say. Paul doesn't mention the exception clause that Jesus does here for immorality, but he does teach the same high view of marriage that Jesus does. Right? The baseline is still, don't get divorced. If it's in your power and in your control, if it's up to you, don't pursue divorce. Nowhere are believers ever commanded to pursue divorce. Rather, the overwhelming expectation in the New Testament and the Old is that we should remain faithful to our marriage covenant and pursue reconciliation when conflict arises. That's the baseline. So just to wrap this little excursus up, you can go back to 1 Corinthians 7 now. Listen to Jay Adams. He captures the Bible's overall posture on divorce in his statement, and I think it's good. He says, though permitted for specific things, divorce is never desirable. All divorces stem from sin, though not all divorces are sinful. I think that's a helpful summary. And I would suggest just that Paul doesn't mention the exception here for sexual sin that Jesus allows in Matthew 19 because, think about what he's doing here, even in that difficult scenario, right? If that ever happened in a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever, for two people who supposedly possess the Holy Spirit, Paul's point here is that divorce is never the only option on the table, even if that sin has occurred. Remember, Paul is writing here to encourage Christians, remember the context, to remain as they are as long as they're able. So it only makes sense that he would leave out this less than ideal allowance for divorce because his point here is that Christians, listen, Christians always have a choice to pursue reconciliation with one another. Guys, think about that. Even when sexual sin and infidelity has occurred in a marriage between two believers, I think Paul's point here is that doesn't leave those two Christians with no choice whatsoever but to divorce. Moses and Jesus both allowed for that option, but it's not mentioned here by Paul because it's never seen as the only recourse then in that situation. Nor was it ever meant to be the preferred course of action. Moses doesn't command divorce in that situation. He simply allows for it. You see the difference? And so we'll come back to that. There's an implication to be drawn from that. But notice, Paul does address here, let's talk about the first part of verse 11 then, a situation in which divorce happens to take place between two believers. So what do we make of that? Notice the exception here that he does actually bring up. Look at verse 11. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. Now, this has been confusing to a lot of people. The big question here is this exception something that Paul sees as a legitimate option for a believer? Or is he warning, is he using it as a deterrent for someone who's disobeyed this command, this clear command not to divorce? In other words, here's how some people have taken it, right? Is Paul saying here, you shouldn't divorce, but if you do, that's okay. You just have to stay single. Or you can remarry your first spouse. Those are your options. And some would say, oh, well, there's my out. I'm just going to stay single. Is that what Jesus is saying here? Paul's saying here? Or is he saying, you shouldn't divorce, and for those who disobey that command, they're not able to remarry another person because that would be adultery. Instead, they should be reconciled with their former spouse. You see the difference? One is a deterrent. The other is, hey, here's an allowance for me. And I would just say, I think it's the second. It's a deterrent and it's a warning. I don't think Paul is condoning or sanctioning someone who just wants out of a marriage and so just decides to remain single. And I'll tell you why. If this was referring to a legitimate exception and Paul didn't think there was a problem with divorcing as long as you remained single afterwards, you would expect him to make that clear and reassure the Corinthians that that wasn't wrong to do, especially given that he's assuming agreement with Jesus' high view of no divorce for just any old reason, right? Notice how he... Notice even in the context, look at verse 15 here later, how Paul feels the need to clarify and reassure the exceptions that he does give later on. Look at verse 15. He does it in this exception. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. And here's the reassurance and clarification for that situation and exception. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. Well, you don't see that language here. You don't see a reassurance that it's okay over here. Notice also, skip down to verse 28. He does this with the exception to the rule in verse 28 by clarifying for his readers and reassuring them there that if any of them decide to get married, hey, look, even though his opinion is for them to remain single, he makes it clear there, look, you have not sinned. You see that? If he were giving a legitimate exception, his pattern is to reassure them that it's okay, right? But how here, notice, there's no reassurance or clarification here given. Instead, what follows is a prohibition and a consequence which agrees with Jesus' teaching about no remarriage after an unbiblical divorce. He gives a warning. In fact, notice, just like Jesus taught in Matthew 5, Paul says here that the person who pursues an unbiblical divorce must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to his or her former spouse. And when you piece that together with what Jesus taught earlier, Matthew 5, you realize that's because remarriage after an unbiblical divorce would be adultery. And so I believe that Paul here at the beginning of verse 11 is speaking of and addressing someone who disobeys this command in verse 10 and divorces unbiblically. And he says the consequence of that is that they should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to their husband. And Paul's point is to encourage reconciliation in those two people. So I don't see this as a legitimate option to be taken by someone who just wants out of their marriage. Notice also here, Paul doesn't. So notice in verse 11 here, Paul doesn't categorically prohibit remarriage for this person of every kind of divorced person, right? And we know that because already, think about it, in verse 9, those who come to Christ as already divorced people should remarry if they want to. We saw that last time. And we know Paul isn't prohibit remarriage for every kind of divorced person, because notice, look forward to verse 15, which we'll see in a moment, that Christians whose unbelieving spouses divorce them are also free to remarry. So here in verse 11, I don't think Paul's not categorically prohibiting remarriage just because someone's been divorced. Just because divorce has occurred, it matters what kind of divorce. If it's unbiblical divorce, then you're in verse 11. But notice even carefully here in verse 11, the prohibition, even for this person who's violated that command, isn't against all remarriage, because they're actually encouraged to remarry who? Who are they encouraged to remarry here in verse 11? Their former spouse, right? So it's not even all remarriage that's prohibited for divorced people. Even in an unbiblical case of divorce, that person can remarry. It just has to be with the person that they divorced. And so that's his point here. If we're being precise, the prohibition here is not against remarriage altogether for anybody who's ever divorced. It's against remarriage to a new spouse for the Christian who has divorced for unbiblical reasons. Hopefully that's clear. That's what Paul is addressing here, a professing believer who has decided to disobey the command in verse 10. And in that scenario, Paul says exactly what Jesus says. That person is not free to marry anyone else, because that would be adultery. The only legitimate option for that person is to be reconciled to their previous spouse. And while that sounds incredibly restrictive to some people, think about this. I would actually argue that this view of marriage between two believers from Jesus and the Apostle Paul is incredibly encouraging and hopeful. Think about this. See, the assumption here, when marriage is between two believers, is that there is always hope for reconciliation and restoration. Do you see that in the text? Might I say then, even in the case of infidelity, Paul leaves that out here because he believes that even in that case, even in the case in which Jesus gave an exception for divorce, for two believers, he says, that's never just your only option. The assumption here when two Christians get married is that there's no problem, there's no difficulty, there's no conflict, there's no sin that is irreconcilable if you both have the Spirit. I think that is so encouraging and so hopeful. The picture painted here, Paul's default position regarding marriage between two believers is that nothing is beyond repair if Jesus is involved. Ever think of it that way? Look, man, that should be so encouraging. It made me think back to 1 Corinthians 5, you know, or actually the beginning of chapter 6 about the lawsuits. Remember that section? You know, where Paul's saying, look, when there's a dispute between brothers, look, you guys have every resource you need in-house, in the Spirit. You should, to find a way to reconcile without having to go to secular courts. Same principle is here, assumed by Paul when it's marriage between two believers. So Paul's silence about the exception clause tells us that sexual sin doesn't have to end in divorce. Sadly, it does sometimes, and that's okay, that's allowed, that's permitted by Jesus and by Moses. But it's not absolutely necessary. It doesn't have to be that way. If both parties are truly in Christ, reconciliation is still possible and can be pursued. Notice here in verse 11, even after a divorce occurs. Think about that. You know what that tells me? Divorce is not final either in a situation like this. Paul leaves the door open for reconciliation and repentance, even when divorce has occurred. I mean, that's incredible. So, J. Adams points out that there are resources, listen, the Word and the Spirit of which both parties may avail themselves. There is a mutually basic commitment to obey Christ, and there's the process of church discipline that in the last resort may be activated if either one or the other or both refuses to deal with problems. There is, therefore, hope for that marriage between two believers and every reason for insisting upon reconciliation. I love that. What are the implications from this? I'll just list them. Well, we're obviously not going to get to verses 12 through 16. So don't worry. I won't go for 2 hours, Mike. Let me just finish here by just some implications here for these two verses in this. Paul, like Jesus, held a high view of marriage. And guys, marriage is to be entered into as a permanent covenant and binding commitment. That should be, as a Christian, look, that's your default, right? That's the thinking of a Christian who's entering marriage. At least it should. And these verses highlight the importance of being equally yoked in a marriage. I mean, think about it, guys, because only two Christians can legitimately say, right, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, with any real hope that they can and will actually work things out. Right? Only Christians can say that with any hope that through thick and thin, even sins like immorality and unfaithfulness, can they still remain committed to one another and be reconciled to each other after conflict? Only Christians can say that. Paul implies that here. And that's all the more brought to light later, as we'll get next time, into verses 12 through 16, because that's where it's different. He'll say, because the other person's an unbeliever, there is a place where there is an impasse and you need to let them go. We'll get to that next time. And yet these verses also remind us, here's another implication, that whenever divorce occurs, it really does end a marriage, even in God's eyes. Okay, I don't know if you've ever heard that like idea that divorce doesn't end a marriage if it's unbiblical divorce, because you're still married in God's eyes. That's not actually a biblical concept. Okay, so if you've ever said that or thought that, you've got to run it through the language of this chapter. Think about this. This is implied by the fact that even when the divorce is for unbiblical reasons here in verse 11, Paul says both people are unmarried. He calls them unmarried. So the reality is, even when it's an unbiblical divorce being enacted, the result is still a dissolving of that union. So there is no such thing as divorced but still married in God's eyes. Okay, that's an unhelpful, unbiblical category that I think confuses counseling situations sometimes. I think people get tripped up on it, because when Jesus says in Matthew 19:6, what God has joined together, let no man separate, you know, they're saying, well, you can't separate what God has joined. He was not warning against an impossibility. Rather, he was warning against disobedience. Okay? He's not saying that can never happen. It's impossible. Once these two people are joined, they're always going to be married in God's eyes. That's not the case. Clearly, Paul says, even in verse 11, when an unbiblical divorce is enacted, that person is unmarried. That's their condition. So those are some implications from that, those two verses, okay? Well, let me stop this here and see if you guys have any questions, because we aren't going to get into verses 12 through 16.